Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Mr. Stick in your eyes.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi and welcome to this week's Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. Well, it is just 7 weeks since the May 21 election, and it has already been analysed in detail by ANU and other political science academics using survey data, and I'm delighted to have two of them with me today to discuss at a more granular level what motivated voters to change their minds from last time and what issues pushed them to do it. And you won't be surprised to hear that Scott Morrison's low personal integrity ratings were among the factors, but there were many more. Last week, the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods and the School of Politics and International Relations held a symposium called Realignment or Dealignment. To really get a sense of just how pivotal this election was it a sort of a temporary thing, an aberration, or does it mark a change in the way Australians are voting? And we'll discuss some of those issues today. I suppose in the end, we'll know that more conclusively when we see the next election. So in other words, 3 years down the track, will some of the things that happened here be reversed or will they be repeated? Will voters continue to drift away from the major parties? We know the crossbench was tripled in size, for example. So, that's a pretty significant event in Australian electoral history. We'll see whether those crossbenches farewell at the next election. Will the crossbench even expand further? It's all open to possibilities. So to discuss all of that, I'm joined by Professor Nicholas Biddle and Intifar Chowdhury. Professor Biddle is an economist and public policy expert and is Associate Director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods. And Intifar Chowdhury is a PhD candidate at ANU, and her research tackles the important question of whether young people are turning away from democracy. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks.
Inti, I might start with you because, as I said, you look at this question about whether young people are turning away from democracy. I wonder, does this election give you any sort of answer to that question? And does it in fact point up that young people might be turning away not so much from democracy but from old politics?
Yeah, young people in Australia are definitely not turning away from democracy. There is a high level of interest and also kind of like a different sort of engagement with Australian politics. And when I say different, it's mostly young people are mostly switched off by elite-directed democratic processes and don't seem to favor political parties as much as their older counterparts. However, young people's politics in Australia seem to be driven, and as election results suggest, by particular issues that are relevant to their lives.
Yeah, so in a sense, it shows that young people are sort of policy-based or issues-driven, as you say, in the way they cast their votes. The way I've described that in the past is that, and it's a generalization, I know, but but that young people tend to think in quite straight lines about these issues. They hold values, they determine what their position is on a particular thing, and are less compromised by a sort of a plethora of other concerns that tend to change the way people vote, the complexities that they bring to those equations later in life. And a party like the Greens tends to, you know, which has not been historically a party of government, tends to be able to relate very well to that constituency because it too can take quite principled positions on things, largely safe in the assumption that they won't actually be controlling the budget and the Treasury benches in order to have to put those policies into place. So there's perhaps a confluence there between this tendency of young people to vote on issues and the rise of the Greens in this election.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, actually. So young voters mostly probably think about, oh, what is the issue at the front of mind, and then try and look for solutions, which most of the time they don't get from major parties. And many, many polls suggest that young people's faith on political institutions and the major political parties has been declining. And hence, they're kind of finding probably perhaps refuge with these Green and Teal independents.
All right, well, we'll come back to some of these issues in a moment. But Nick, can I get from you first what the main survey findings are? And if you could perhaps just explain to Democracy Sausage, all of us around the barbecue here, what this survey is, how it came about and what makes it different. Because as I said, we are we've only just had the election, and yet we already have this rich trove of data about what people thought and what changed, you know, what influenced their votes.
Yeah, sure. So we have a long-standing survey on general social issues, ANU poll, and we usually ask about between 3,000 and 3,500 people around a range of issues, maybe 3 or 4 times a year, a little bit more during the COVID period. So our most recent one of those surveys was in April 2022. And in addition to asking things like your experience with COVID, your vaccination status, your well-being, we asked a few kind of policy questions and also voting intention. So that was kind of our pre-election survey, started in the field just after the election was called, while the campaign had just started. And then in May, at the end of May, just after the election result itself, we then went back to the same individuals and asked them a range of political questions, including who they voted for in the Senate and the House of Reps, who they voted for in 2019, their trust in a range of institutions, their views on the leaders. And a really important question which we asked by linking to April survey, we were able to ask, you know, why did you change? Why did you change your view from April to May? In April, you said you're going to vote for the coalition. You ended up voting independent. Why? Or you said you're going to vote Greens and you end up voting for the coalition. Why was that? So we have a really rich set of data from pre and post-election. We were able to really drill into some of the factors influencing people's votes. And also a really interesting one, we asked, okay, how happy were you with your voting? How happy are you now with the direction of the country? So as you mentioned, we've got a few papers out already. The data is available through the Australian Data Archive, so anyone can jump online and download it and do their own analysis. And there's still heaps of analysis to come.
So, and a key strength of this, therefore, and this makes it different from the sort of normal, I suppose, what we might call retail polls that people would be familiar with, the ones that bob up in the papers every, you know, month or 6 weeks or fortnight or whatever it might be for the different media companies. But the difference here is that, well, perhaps you can explain it. These are the same people, by and large, that are being questioned and re-questioned. And how are they selected?
Yeah, so they are the same people, and that's a really rich part of our data set. So if you did the May survey, you've got about a 93.5% chance that you did the April survey. So the vast majority of those who we have their actual voting, we have who they intended to vote for in April and even before then. So these people are selected, essentially they're from the Life in Australia panel, which is called a probability-based panel. So people are recruited via fixed line phone and mobile phones. they're asked to be on this panel. And then for those who are on the panel, they're then asked to fill in a survey essentially every month. The ANU doesn't survey every month. So one month they might be doing a survey for us, and then another month they might be doing it for another client or a commercial client. So they're asked a range of questions pretty repeatedly. So they're pretty sophisticated respondent, but we have young Australians, so adults, young Australians, older Australians, remote, non-remote, born in Australia, not born in Australia. We have a pretty rich distribution across the kind of the categories which you would be interested in, both from a policy perspective in terms of understanding people's outcomes, but also from kind of a segment of the population to understand their views and their voting behaviours.
And is there any danger in, or is there an increased risk, might be a better way of putting it, that the group that we're talking to through this mechanism are more engaged than normal people, that by saying yes to participating in the survey and to the prospect of participating in future surveys, that they are perhaps as a cohort fractionally more engaged than ordinary people? That's the first thing. Or that they become more engaged as a result of the participation process, almost like the uncertainty principle, where we're trying to look at them, and in looking at them, we change them somehow.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a real risk, and there's a few ways we try and mitigate that. One is to have a reasonably frequent refresh of the panel, so those who've been in for a while might get retired, and then new panelists are recruited. It's also a little bit different to some of the opt-in panels where people kind of search online to try and find surveys to participate or to give their views. These are people who are recruited. And we get some pretty, I wouldn't say disengaged, but some people who are not overly enamored with the political process. So it's not just those who are following Twitter. There's also, we ask, why did you change your vote? And we kind of have some open-ended responses, and your people say, oh, because all politicians are idiots, or all politicians are corrupt, or I just didn't care. You asked me in April, and I don't know, I just made up a number, and then you asked me again, and I made up a different number. So we get all all types, and we try and balance the panel and compare our results to external data to make sure that it's as close as possible. But you're right. So being asked about your intention in April makes you think about it maybe a little bit earlier than someone else might have. And we certainly do see in our data that there's not an insignificant proportion of people who made their mind up really close to the election and potentially being involved in surveys, even if it doesn't change who you would vote for. It might change the strength with which you hold that view, or it might entrench certain views. So we do our best, and we also qualify things, and this is just one sample, and if we're getting drastically different results to someone else, then we'll make sure that there's nothing biasing our conclusions. The other thing I would say is that surveys like this are only one part of the story, and I think qualitative data, in-depth interviews with voters can really kind of flesh out the story which you get from these large-scale surveys.
I remember Brian Loughnane back in the days when he was federal director of the Liberal Party saying to me one day in Parliament House, I think we must have been talking because of a poll that was out that day. I was at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age at the time, and we probably had a poll out that day. And he said to me, "You people are wasting your money asking people who would you vote for if an election were held this Saturday. It's 18 months to an election. It's completely hypothetical." I mean, at the time I thought, well, there's definitely some validity in that point. Of course, in a democracy, we are interested, and it is a news story. It is a matter of some fascination, how a government is travelling, how policies are being received, what voters are thinking about where the government is at the moment. That is a matter of some interest. But of course, there's been some concern, I suppose, about just the scale of polling, the role of them, the extent to which they may themselves become part of the sort of political events, that they may influence the outcomes as much as they reflect what is going on. And we've certainly seen a bit of that in terms of expectations in elections and places where the polls have got it wrong and so forth. But it's a fascinating area, and there's always some level of uncertainty around these things. But this poll, as you say, this survey series, ANU poll, particularly looks to get around some of those things with the sheer scale of the people surveyed, and as you say, all of those other things built into it, including the fact that you have people answering over a period of time, and so that you can track those changes.
Yeah, and just on that, so one of the really interesting things is we can track how much people's votes do change from 18 months out or 6 months out or 1 month out from the election. And if there was no information, then you would expect that whether you said you're going to vote for the coalition in April should have no bearing on whether you ended up voting for the coalition. And clearly that's not the case. So we found that only 22% of people changed their votes between April 2022 and May, and then the election, which is actually really similar to last election. So that was 21.5% who changed their votes. So it's certainly true that people do change, and there is some fluctuation, and that's really interesting, that what those fluctuations are and their directions. But I do think there is some information in kind of asking people out a month or 6 months or 12 months out from an election, especially if you're qualifying that, and if you're saying, well, okay, this is people's views now. In the current environment, doesn't mean that that's not who they're going to vote for, but it's not predictive. It's
an
indication rather than a determination. And I think where we go wrong in Australia is not necessarily the number of polls which we do, and certainly we're no worse than other countries. I think where we can go wrong is the reliance of those polls as a forecast rather than a nowcast.
And the timing of the poll is quite important. I actually found this, I was working with AES, so Australian Election Study Data, and I actually found that Australians tend to have incredibly short-term memory, right? And by that, I mean what really affects us the most. And I did like a life cycle and a generation and a period effect analysis. So looking into what impacts the vote the most, and I found out that the effect of the period is the most significant for Australians, and this is what makes the timing of the poll so important, because the campaign is incredibly important. So what the leaders are signaling, how they're campaigning, things they are talking about, are they really tapping into issues that voters care about? And this time around, voters all across the board, right? So young voters, older voters, women, all voters were mostly concerned about the cost of living. That was one of the biggest issues that concerned voters, which also came up in the ANU poll, right? And this had a significant effect on coalition losing their voters or other parties or other independents or minor parties gaining votes away from the major parties. So really, the timing of the poll is really important, because people might change their vote close to the election depending on the campaign.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So you can track it, and you can learn, therefore, we can all learn, therefore, what the effect of certain events, certain attempts to portray information or portray the shortcomings of one's opponents in the political process, how those things actually played out. That's very interesting. And I think, you know, when people criticize polls and criticize news organizations for running them, it always strikes me as being a bit unrealistic. Of course, we are interested in a democracy, in what people think, and we're not just interested in what the voters think about the government at the moment they vote for it. We're interested in knowing that through the period. We don't want to have an election every week, but of course, it's fascinating to know whether a political direction that's being taken is supported by people or not, whether the government's losing support or gaining support, whether certain issues that have come up have become front of mind for voters and they want to see their political leaders actually lead for a change on some of these things. Fascinating stuff. And of course, we're going to want to look at it. Why don't we just take a quick break there, because we're about halfway through. We'll take a quick break and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. Now, before I interrupted myself, I was about to say, let's look at the hierarchy of issues. What were the main issues that voters were valuing in the sort of critical period leading up to this election, Nick? Was it and did it change? Was it different for different age groups?
Yeah, so I might answer the first part, and then Inti's looked in a fair bit of detail about how these issues vary across different population groups. So we found in April that, as Inti mentioned, cost of living, reducing the cost of living was what voters saw as being a top priority for whatever the new government would be. What was really interesting is the aged care system. Fixing the aged care system was the second highest priority, and that kind of reflects not necessarily kind of a short term, but a building realization both leading into COVID, but also during COVID, that the current aged care system is not fit for purpose.
And that was reflected across all age groups, wasn't it? Even young people thought of that.
Young people care about aged care as well.
Yeah, I remember Inti and I having a bit of a chat about it. It was via email. She was like, wow, you know, is that right? You know, are you sure that that's kind of the highest priority? Yeah, it is. And it's one of those things where, and if you think about it, it's not just people who are worried about their own retirement or their own when they need to kind of increase the amount of care which they receive. It's people who've seen their grandparents experience or they've seen their parents struggle with caring for both them as children, but also a kind of elderly grandparent.
Or they know aged care workers in their family working themselves to deaths for low incomes and doing extra shifts and, you know, really living their work and not getting much value attached to it by their pay packet.
Yeah, and I think what our data really shows, both with this current election, but also within election periods, is that sure, people vote or express views which are, you know, somewhat self-interested. So if you're at the top of the income distribution, you probably rather lower taxes. If you're bottom, you probably rather increased transfer payments, and that's true, and that's been true for a number of years. But it's not. It doesn't determine people's votes. There's a lot of people who have no exposure to or no requirement to be using the aged care system at the moment, who see it as a priority. There's a number of very wealthy people who feel that, you know, taxes on the wealthy should be much higher. And there's people who maybe themselves and even their children have already been through the education system, who see it as a need to engage and fix the education system. So, you know, the aged care and generational views is an example of that, but there's plenty of other examples in our data. So the other thing we looked at, which I found, you know, really fascinating, is, okay, so let's look at people who changed their votes. Let's look at people who voted for the coalition in 2019, but voted for another party in 2022. What did they care about? And essentially, if you care about climate change, then you're far more likely to have moved your vote away from the coalition. If you care about disaster relief, you're more likely to have deserted the coalition, and improving the way the political system works. And finally, one which I was a little surprised by, but I think is reflected maybe in the some of the discussion post-election, is that those who said that addressing issues around race in the country, if they saw that as a priority, they're more likely to have left the coalition. And to me, that's an indication of some support for a more, I guess, nuanced and productive debate around Indigenous voice in Parliament and responding to the Uluru Statement of the Heart. So to me, they're the four, well, for our data, they're the four things which influence the change in vote. And things which, kept people with the coalition were issues which didn't really feature in the election. So terrorism, migration, and trade, certainly they haven't gone away, but they weren't necessarily front of mind amongst voters. And they're the issues which, as Inti said, timing is different. If those issues became more salient, then maybe the election could have gone quite differently.
Yeah, Inti?
Yeah, and I also think very positively, I actually think that there has been a shift away from perhaps egocentric voting, and maybe this is a bold statement that I'm making, but I do see across age groups this consciousness, this compassion in Australian voters for other groups or other people. So as Nick mentioned, there were people, older people with money who were concerned about, you know, what's going to happen to my kids, or people who were worried, older people as well. Leading up to the election, I realized in various panels, talking to various people, that there were older people who cared about climate change more so than previous elections, right? So I do tend to see a compassion for other age groups and other groups in total. Coming back to your question about what is the distribution of policy priorities across age groups, so if we divide, so this is again using the ANU poll results that came out, and drawing on from the symposium as well, if we divide the Australian electorate into three age groups, the youngest being 18 to 34, and the mid group being 35 to 54, and the oldest being 55 plus. Young people mostly cared about reducing the cost of living. There's dealing with global climate change, improving the education system, not a surprise there. Reducing healthcare costs, obviously, after COVID, this is as expected. And also fixing the aged care system. And if you look into more broadly, then you will see that all Australians were concerned about reducing the cost of living, fixing the aged care system, as Nick mentioned, and also reducing healthcare costs, again, as expected after COVID. All across the board, there are Australians who think that, yes, people are suffering from the rising cost of living, inflation, so context, period effect again, and also seeing that the aged care system is definitely not fit for purpose. This again comes back to, you know, people's lies. So as you mentioned, Mark, that perhaps there is someone who has parents or who has household member working in the aged care facility. So really seeing the sufferings or change of hours due to COVID, etc. So this comes back to the idea of lifestyle politics, of how your life is being impacted by all these issues and how you might reflect those experiences of your life at the poll. So really there's a massive shift, as I see it, away from towing along party lines to seeing, okay, what matters for me right now, or what matters for my parents, or what matters for people I care about, or the community even, and voting accordingly.
Yeah, that issue of that idea you raise, Inti, of compassion being an issue and of understanding the world beyond your immediate sort of self-interest, it's an encouraging idea, and I think I like it, and I think it probably is right. I think we, and Nick was touching on this as well, we see a growing sense of concern for for climate change, not just in terms of its impact upon our lives, but in terms of, you know, the broader impact on the globe, the broader impact on the people who and the species who are affected by it most. We also see it perhaps in this aged care question in young people. Just, I mean, we've talked about, you know, having connection with the aged care sector itself one way or another, but also perhaps just looking on your television news as we did through those dark days of the lockdown and seeing elderly people behind glass. You know, sometimes family members were able to sort of, you know, wave to them or whatever, because so many of these facilities were in lockdown themselves, you know, and it was horrendous. It was to think in a first world country that we were in a situation where these facilities were so badly run, in some cases, so underfunded, so poorly equipped with primary health care that the organized, you know, the managers of them decided that their best way to handle it was to, you know, effectively seal off the facility. This, I think, probably did touch a lot of people's sense of what is reasonable, you know, just as at a human level.
So I was going to say that I think the pandemic in broad terms opened people's eyes to aspects of society which they may not have seen beforehand. So aged care was one, and right early in the pandemic, midway through, when a kind of vaccines were an issue in Australia, we still found a very large proportion of people who said that Australia should be prioritizing kind of vaccines in our neighboring countries in the Pacific, but also in developing countries. Yes. So I think there's the experience during COVID may have revealed things. And also I think it did highlight to some people that others are making sacrifices either in kind of aged care workers in terms of what they're doing as a living, or educators, or there's a range of or those in kind of working, even working in retail.
Yeah, people doing deliveries, drivers and all kinds of
things. And why I think this was possible is probably 100% sure that it's because of information and exposure and quick and easy information. We are, there is obviously living in Australia, we have by the virtue of advanced technology, we get to see, as you mentioned, Mark, right, getting to see in the TV that people are suffering. So I think exposure is a very big thing here as well, getting to know about what is happening in other people's lives. So, and in that process, sort of developing a sense of compassion for others. And during the pandemic, people were locked behind their computers mostly, and getting to, you know, seeing all these. And the media has a very big role here, right? Plays a very big role here, right? To disseminate all this information about what's happening to people, not just in your immediate community, but beyond as well, right? So I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we saw this in Britain, didn't we? You remember Boris Johnson had his own brush with mortality when he had COVID quite severely and was basically on a ventilator, I think. And he came out and talked about the NHS as the beating heart of Britain. They didn't fund it as well as they could, but the general population the support for the NHS in Britain just skyrocketed because people could see, as you say, into the sort of coverage of all of this, aspects of services and the people working in those services that we largely take for granted or that which we only have occasional intersections with, we're getting covered. And we saw healthcare workers who were being pushed to the absolute limits, who were gowned and, you know, wearing PPE in extraordinary circumstances and getting the infection themselves at a higher rate than the general population because of that exposure, and we saw that, and it was a eye-opening experience, and perhaps it has unlocked a level of broader concern of a sense of the community, because we did trust which comes up in this ANU survey. Trust does climb during this period in government, in services, in our emergency first responders and so forth. There's a bounce in it, and that, you know, that gradually ebbs away through the various underperformances with the vaccine and so forth. It really, I think, has given us a new window into how some of these things are mediated, how we understand them, what our response is to them, and it's not all as some people would have us believe, it's not all about selfishness and what we can get out of it. It's about being a member of a community.
Absolutely. And it also reveals so many cracks in not just the political system, but also healthcare system and also aged care facilities, etc. And it kind of also probably makes accountability easier to hold political leaders accountable. The comparative study of electoral system along with ANU poll shows that a lot of the voters who thought about handling of the pandemic also thought about how, you can link that to the unpopularity of Scott Morrison. So people who were not happy with Scott Morrison, didn't like him as a leader, was particularly because of how he handled the pandemic. So really, coalition lost quite a bit of vote there as well. There is also a real risk of misinformation in all this, right? How the media is portraying all this information, especially around COVID. But it is quite fascinating that this time around, survey results show that Australians don't believe social media as much, do not trust social media as much as you would have thought, which also kind of shows that people are kind of, there's digital literacy, right, as well. So people know where the information is coming from, which one to trust and which one to not.
Yeah. Nick, just going back to some of the issues, one of the, you were talking before about some of the issues that were front of mind and some of those that I suppose you might call markers or surrogate markers of intention to change votes. Also in there, I noticed that there were some of the issues that, you know, are always burbling around in Australian politics, but which really fell down the list in terms of their importance. The recent election campaign did not focus much on balancing the budget because that's an impossible, you know, it's impossible. I mean, we've got deficits as far as the eye can see, gross debt, you know, sort of nudging towards $1 trillion. So that was off the table, but also things like increased defence spending as an idea or national security. You mentioned terrorism before. Some of these things were sort of way down the list, weren't they?
Yeah, so I think there's a few reasons for that. One is just because of the real salience of price increases as the election was taking place. But also I think that if you think about the dynamics of the issue around budget deficits over the last, for decades now, there's been a view that the coalition conservative side of politics, they are better at balancing the budget and that Labor is profligate. And that has never really been that supported by the data, but it's really hard for Scott Morrison and Frydenberg leading into the election to argue that they're able to manage the budget deficit, but Labor isn't, given, as you said, that a budget came out not too long before the election, which showed these really large deficits. But then on the flip side, given that history, it's also hard, I think, for Labor to, it was hard for Labor to focus on the budget deficit to make that an issue themselves. So there was an interest for both parties to kind of downplay that. I was actually a little surprised that the military and defence and to a lesser extent terrorism rank so lowly, given what was happening in Ukraine and still happening in Ukraine leading up to and during the election campaign. So I guess that's still far enough distant geographically for Australians to certainly recognise what's going on and recognise the importance of the Western Alliance and others in supporting Ukraine, but not to see it as something which is necessarily directly influencing them.
And I suppose from a political terrain point of view, these are areas that have generally been strengths for the coalition or perceived as such, the kind of ground a coalition wants to fight an election on, such as, you know, fiscal rectitude, stronger commitment to defence spending, being tougher on national security issues and having the spine to do it and so forth. These are the kind of tropes that they would like to have current in an election, as you say, salient in an election. And when they aren't on the agenda, then it it's tying the coalition one of its hands behind its back a bit, and perhaps that also is therefore reflected in the issues that are to the fore and the result in the end.
Yeah, and certainly a government who is in power has a greater capacity to shape the political discourse and what's happening and what's being discussed. But it's not it doesn't have a perfect ability.
No, I was going to say it's right up until it doesn't.
Sure, you know? That's right. And we certainly saw that. Yeah, that the people were asking repeatedly of former Prime Minister Morrison and former Treasurer Jos Frydenberg, you know, issues. They're asking questions which weren't comfortable for the coalition to answer. And there's certainly limits of that, and government can still make an announcement and they can still choose the timing of the budget, and there's certainly things they can do, but it's not absolute. And I think certainly in this election, the issues got away from the government. The issues which were salient were cost of living, aged care, education, climate change, disaster relief. These are the things which people cared about, and these were the things which the former government didn't have a very convincing story to tell.
Now, Inti, I want to come to in a moment, just you know, Morrison and Joyce, their unpopularity. But before I do that, I'm going to ask you a question, and I'll get Nick to respond to this as well. But this is just about the overall survey approach. I'm wondering, do you think we should be surveying in these types of surveys, including in the survey group, 16-year-olds? I mean, if you think about 16-year-olds now, they're going to be voting at the next election. So do you think that's a group that is
undercalled? 100%. I think they should be, because 16-year-olds today are so different from 16-year-olds even 20 years ago, right? They're more politically sophisticated, they are well informed, they have more exposure to diverse sort of information, they're highly educated. So if you look in track education system across generations, then you will see that younger generations tend to be more educated compared to their counterparts in previous generations. So they do have the tools and the resources to be able to make an informed political judgment at both at the polls and also in opinion surveys. So I think they are grossly really underpolled. It's very, very important. I don't know when this is going to happen. I don't know how to convince people to make this happen, but yeah, it needs to happen.
Yeah, interesting point. What about you, Nick?
Yeah, look, so we're recording this on the 28th of June, which is Census Day. It is Christmas for stats nerds. I think a few people refer to it as it only happens every 5 years.
And you're a stats nerd, aren't you?
I am indeed. And one of the things which we did last census, we asked kids what they thought should be in the census. And the responses were fascinating. They said, well, why don't you ask us about, you ask about how people travel to work. Why don't you ask about how people travel to school? Or you ask us about where we live, but do you ask whether there's playgrounds where we live? So I don't think it's just the interviews which are interesting. I think it's the extent to which the issues which are asked about, the extent to which they can be influenced by young Australians, you know, 16, 15, 14, 12, however young you want to go. Because those issues, the issues which get raised, are as important, I think, as the answers. And there are surveys, and you know, as an example, the longitudinal study of Australian children has been tracking the views of children over a number of years, and some kind of social attitude surveys do ask kids, but not enough. And not enough asking kids what they care about, and then using those to maybe ask to adults. You know, ask adults, well, why don't you vote based on playgrounds, or why don't you vote based on I don't know the bike paths in the area? I'm just making things up based on the discussion we had previously. So yeah, I think there is a real need to do that and to do it carefully and to manage privacy. And it's not to say that it's simple to interview kids or that there's not risks, but I think the benefits of doing so far outweigh those risks.
100%. And at the moment, I'm working with a longitudinal survey, which is called the First School Destination Survey, where mostly we really want to look at 15-year-olds, track them for the next 10 years, and see how their attitudes and behaviors change, mostly in terms of their educational aspirations, their career aspirations, but also how things like COVID impacted their lives and personal relationships, political attitudes, and civic participation as well. So I think more of these surveys are definitely necessary. As Nick mentioned, there is a real risk of going to 15 or 16-year-olds and asking them about all these issues, but definitely the benefits outweigh the risk.
Yeah, that's right. There may be some ethical considerations there, but it's an interesting field. I mean, the Greens at one point at least, I think, have advocated that 16-year-olds should have the vote. Do you, Inti, think that is something that should be considered, given that at 16 years old you can do a lot of other things?
Yeah, you can acquire a driver's
including
car.
Drive
yeah,
a car.
Yeah, you can drive a car, you can consent, and then why not vote? Because voting is a right to be able to have a say at the rules that impact your lives directly. I think it's important to engage young people also in terms of like youth engagement, because voting is a habit that you develop, and the earlier you're exposed to this institution, the better it is for voters and also for democracy.
What about the concept of making it? I've thought about this a bit, and not in a particularly methodological way, I might say, just sort of mused on it. But what about possibilities like making it non-compulsory for 16-year-olds, only becomes compulsory when it's 18, or perhaps some sort of civic certificate where you've it's like a provisional voting license where you're able to vote, but you have to have satisfied some level of instructional course on essentially, you know, what the institutions are and the major parties represent or whatever it is.
I think, well, two things. I am a staunch supporter of compulsory voting, and I do. And I believe that in Australia, you do know that in other parts, other advanced democracies similar to Australia, there is a real problem of young people disengaging from the whole institution of voting, right? And this is a very big problem, which we don't see. There's no evidence for it in Australia. The younger voters and younger generations are quite comparable when it comes to their engagement at the polls. So, and I believe that it's because of the political culture instilled in by compulsory voting. But there also is a real need of, as you kind of lightly touch upon, of civic and political education, which perhaps could be facilitated by educational institutions like schools in order to help young people to get some sort of like a certificate of understanding of how politics works in the parliament, etc., before they can make an informed judgment about voting. So what is really necessary is not making voting non-compulsory, but really helping young people to make that informed judgment. I would still stick with compulsory voting. If you ask
me. Oh, yeah,
me.
Don't worry. I wasn't suggesting that we dilute that in any way. I was more just suggesting that for those who want to engage, seems to me a shame in some way. Many 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds are more engaged, more
Absolutely.
Informed about the issues than a good many voters who voted 20 times in their lives, you know, who take no real interest in it. You know, as Nick was saying before, there are some people who don't take any interest in it and who sort of go along and do it. So the idea that an engaged 16-year-old it lacks the competence to participate, and they have a bigger stake in society anyway when you think about the likelihood
Absolutely.
That they're going to be around for a lot longer. It matters to them more. So, yeah, there's a lot of good reasons why it ought to be considered, and you can understand why perhaps on the conservative side they're a bit unenthusiastic about this, because there's probably going to be a proclivity toward the left unused part of the electorate. But anyway, look, we're running short of time. I just want to get to one final question if I can, and that is something I mentioned in the intro, and that is the unpopularity of Scott Morrison and Barnaby Joyce. We had Ed Cooper on the program last week talking about the Teal campaigns and the digital messaging there. And one of the things he said was that, you know, a vote for Dave Sharma or a vote for Josh Frydenberg is a vote for Barnaby Joyce, that they thought that would be the most potent sort of critical message to get to voters. But they found that, in fact, saying that a vote for Josh Frydenberg was actually a vote for Scott Morrison tracked even worse. It was even more toxic. And I don't think the general polls had showed up that level of antipathy in the electorate, Nick. You know, we see better PM ratings and approval, disapproval ratings and so forth, but they didn't show the level of negativity around the Prime Minister. There was certainly plenty of discourse around it, you know, in terms of the things that had been said by colleagues and so forth. But what did the survey show up about Scott Morrison's unpopularity?
Yeah, so look, I think there was certainly hints pre-election that Scott Morrison was not having a positive influence on the coalition vote. But I think there was an assumption that, well, he's a great campaigner. He'll turn it around. And that I'm sure leading up to the election, Morrison was a bit on the nose, but you know, there was this view that it was going to turn around, but he didn't. And certainly our data showed that going back to 1987, that Scott Morrison was the least popular Liberal leader. Barnaby Joyce was the least popular kind of Nationals leader.
So does that mean does that mean among people who vote for that side?
So both, yes. So that was what was really fascinating. And Professor Ian McAllister, from who collaborated with us on the symposium, the point he made was that, okay, you kind of expect that Morrison's not going to be popular amongst Labor voters or Barnaby Joyce. But what he found in his analysis in the data is that even amongst coalition voters, even those who kind of held their nose and voted for the coalition, or those who may have indicated a long-term kind of affiliation with the coalition, even amongst that group, Morrison was deeply unpopular. And you saw that. I mean, there's kind of, I mean, you mentioned the start, I'm trained as an economist, and we like to use the term kind of revealed preference. Scott Morrison's revealed preference was not to campaign in a number of electorates. Yeah. You know, he didn't go to the marginal seats where,
or to the safe, to those blue ribbon seats. You know,
exactly. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, the ones which ended up switching, and so I think the parties, Morrison was not able to turn that around, and so when you kind of ask the question right at the start, was this a long-term shift or a short-term shift? What we'll see is whether with a new leader of the coalition, and it might be Peter Dutton going into the next election, or it might be someone else, whether it was just a Morrison issue or whether it was something more structural and fundamental about the political parties and how people view the issues and how people view the parties with response to those issues.
It's been absolutely terrific having both of you on to discuss all of these issues. There's so much. We've only really scratched the surface of this survey data. As Nick said, you can access it and have a look at your own. And there are some academic papers that have already been written, and there will be more that are coming. So there's plenty of analysis to go, and it is such a fascinating election. We haven't even seen Parliament sit yet. We know there's already friction between the government and the crossbench over resourcing, number of staff and so forth. We'll see where that goes. It's just going to be a really interesting period, and as I say, we'll learn some way down the track whether some of these things signal a hinge point where politics was forever different after the 2022 election, or whether there's some sort of, you know, track back towards the orthodoxy as we've been used to. All of these things are very much in flux at the moment. Nick Biddle and Intifar Choudhury, I always butcher your name, I'm sorry, Choudhury, thank you so much for being on Democracy Sausage.
Thanks for having us on.
And Inti, you can probably tell me right now, how do you pronounce your name?
It's Choudhury.
So I can get it right next time.
Yes, Choudhury. There you go.
Right. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Yes.
At least you
very
you
sorry.
Pronounce my first name all right. You have no idea how people butcher my first name, which is always a surprise to me, right? Because
it's very phonetic. It's a very phonetic first
right
name.
Place, like,
It does. And as you say, on the as you say, Nick, on this day when the census data comes out and we find that the multicultural Australia, the number of people who have a parent born overseas, the number of people who have a foreign or a different other than English language spoken in their home has increased dramatically. So, yes. Anyway, that's Democracy Sausage for now. So thanks very much. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.